Hi, welcome back to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, where leading psychologists share their most recent work. This week, I had so much fun chatting with Josh Jackson, a newly minted assistant professor of behavioral science at University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. In his research, Josh studies how culture co-evolves with psychology. He's interested in how culture has shaped the mind throughout human history and how it continues to shape human futures. He regularly publishes in the field's best journals with innovative methods and is by many considered a rising star in psychology. In this chat, we talk about culture and morality. Why do some cultures have a crude view of another's morality as either all good or all bad, when some cultures have a more nuanced view? Can we ever truly know how kind someone is? How does social media impact our sense of morality? Finally, Josh shares his exciting journey across the whole globe to find his identity as an academic and opens up about the hopes and anxieties he has over becoming a professor. Hope you enjoy. Very excited this week to be talking with Josh Jackson for the Stanford Psychology Podcast. Thank you so much for making the time.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. I'm excited for the conversation.
All right, let's talk about morality. And then we'll get a lot more specific, I promise. First of all, we'll be talking about morality. What even is that? Some people might say, okay, so we'll be talking about religion? Is that what we'll be talking about? What is morality? And then to set up the paper, what is localized versus generalized morality?
You're asking questions that I myself was asking about 5 or 6 years ago. So I'm a moral psychologist, or at least morality is one of the things I'm interested in as a psychologist. But when I was starting out my PhD, I didn't actually quite know what that meant. I knew that it was involving whether we think of people as trustworthy, cooperative versus not trustworthy or antisocial. So we might say someone's moral if they're pro-social and generous and respectful, and immoral if they're selfish or dishonest. But they're actually weird words, moral and immoral. They have such vague meanings that it's actually very difficult to pin someone down with exactly what they're talking about when they talk about morality. And it's part of the inspiration for the research that we're going to speak about today was just me not really knowing where that word came from and what it means.
Wonderful. Okay, let's try to see if we can get a dent into this and get a little bit more of a specific understanding. You differentiate between people having a very generalized moral sense of others as good or bad versus a more localized sense of Tom is like loyal to his friends, but maybe doesn't really care about his cat enough and is a little bit suspicious on that front. Can you talk about this distinction a little bit?
Definitely. So, I mean, what's at the heart of this paper is this distinction between localized and generalized morality. And the logic behind this is none of us are saints or sinners in all ways. You can be generous with your time, but really selfish when it comes to sharing food with a date or your spouse. And so what I was interested in is, why do some people see others as just good or bad along one spectrum of what I call generalized morality? So just you collapse all those different ways that someone can be generous or selfish. And then why do others really bring nuance to how they see morality? They allow people's moral character to vary along different dimensions. So if I took a generalized morality approach to seeing you, Eric, I might say, Eric is either good in all ways or bad in all ways. Versus if I took a localized morality approach, I would acknowledge the fact that you might be good in some ways and bad in others. And just to return to what I mentioned earlier about the start of this project, what I think the word morality conveys is really generalized morality. When we speak about someone as being moral or immoral, what we're actually saying is that they're moral and immoral in all ways. And that was what I found so peculiar. Why do we use this word that obviously doesn't actually convey the texture of our moral characters and that assumes that people are going to be either bad and good in all the different ways they can be bad and good?
Okay, so the next question, of course, has to be, who sees others in this more generalized way of good and bad versus a more localized way? And this is where your paper comes in, talking about networks and network size.
This kind of ties back to that original problem. Where does this word morality come from, and why do we use it so frequently today? Now, I'm a psychologist, but I also work with a lot of linguists, and I'm really interested in the way that language can tell us about why we think the way we do today and what might be more historically recent about the way we think. What I notice is that the word morality is actually quite a recent word in a lot of languages, including English. In English, it comes from when the Latin historian Cicero translated Aristotle's Ethics. And so morality was actually a translation of Aristotle's Ethikos. But of course, it means something very different today. It means this generalized form of something's deep universal goodness in all ways. And so what I thought might be the case, and where this project started, is that perhaps our view of goodness and badness has become increasingly generalized across history. And one reason it might be increasingly generalized is that our groups have expanded and expanded to the point that we interact with far more strangers, far more people we don't really have much contact with, and that we've been forced into a more generalized way of seeing morality. And the prediction from that is that not only has generalized morality perhaps become more common across history, but if we looked around the world to see in the different kinds of communities where people live today, perhaps generalized morality would be most common among people who live in big cities, who inhabit large social networks, and as a group urbanizes or becomes more connected with the rest of the world, perhaps generalized morality is a product of that process.
So is that like a cognitive processing kind of thing? So I have my family back home, I have my friends at work, I have my colleagues. I don't even have time to get to know my neighbors. I literally don't know who they are. And I guess if I had to approach them, maybe I'm tempted to say, are they a good or bad person just because I don't have the bandwidth to compute all the details about their moral character?
There are a couple of different ways of seeing it. One is that maybe it's just a natural extension of getting to know people better. So I don't really know much about politicians. From my perspective, politicians are either good or bad. But I know a lot about my two sisters. And I would never call my sisters moral or immoral because that just doesn't capture the complex people that they are. And so one potential route to generalize morality in big groups is that it's just we start with really abstract conceptions of people's character, including their moral character. And then over time, as we get to know them better, we develop more less abstract, more specific conceptions of their character that are more localized to different kinds of situations. What we argue in the paper is perhaps in addition to that, there's actually a functional component. And this is a complicated idea, but the idea is that when we see people's moral character as nuanced and localized, it's actually really helpful for predicting the different ways they might cooperate or be selfish in different kinds of situations. So if I see you as generous but dishonest, which is maybe a perfectly valid way of seeing you, I know that I can trust you to lend me money if I ever fall on hard times, but I should never share my secrets with you. The more localized you get, the better you can be at making predictions. But when you don't acknowledge the fact that dishonesty and selfishness might correlate across situations, then you risk being in a situation where you don't want to make predictions about anyone's behavior until you see them in that situation. And so generalized morality can be functional because it's an inference tool. You can use an observation about someone's generosity to also make an inference about their honesty and about every other kind of cooperative act that you could potentially need to predict. And as groups get really big and we know less about our interaction partners, then it becomes actually more functional to assume that all kinds of morality are correlated because it's going to help you infer how to predict someone's behavior in a situation where you haven't interacted with them before. I don't know. Is that clear?
Very clear and very fascinating and almost a little bit provocative to me as a social psychologist who I have read so many papers about situations determine behavior, right? People can be morally good in one situation and bad in another. Even the nicest people can do the most horrible things if put in the right context or the wrong context and the other way around. But of course, the personality psychologist in me might say, maybe there's some stability across time and someone who's really kind is not going to turn into a psychopath overnight. Yeah. And I know that your supplementary studies, you actually looked at how much moral behavior correlates across context, which seems like an interesting contribution in and of itself to the field. So how big is the claim that you're making that there is a correlation across contexts?
That's a really good question. I think that we all have a social psychologist and a personality psychologist having a battle in our head all the time. Mm-hmm. We're always trying to figure out how much is this behavior really diagnostic of someone's character versus how much is the situation really imposing on them and getting them, making them act in a particular way. Actually, one of my favorite classes when I was an undergraduate student, Professor John Lydon at McGill, if you ever listen to this, thank you so much for this class, but it was on the big controversy that happened and the schism between personality and social psychology in the late 1960s, early 1970s, when a social psychologist called Walter Mischel published a book called Personality and Assessment. What Mischel found is that most kinds of behaviors will correlate about 0.2 to 0.3 across situations. Translated to generosity, for example, your generosity sharing time with someone who wants your help on a task will only moderately correlate with your generosity giving money to an unhoused person you might pass on the street later that day. And this was a big deal because personality, the theory of personality always assumed that these were quite stable traits that should predict someone's behavior in a range of situations. And generalized morality in that sense is really puzzling because now as social psychologists that we know about this variance in cooperation, how could you ever think that we should be collapsing across all this variance and just thinking about people as good or bad? It turns out in my pilot studies that it gets even more curious because cooperation across different situations correlates even a little less across situations than other kinds of behavior that Mischel was documenting. And so what we were looking at in those pilot studies was people's self-reported likelihood of being pro-social in a range of situations, like if someone needed help with food or building materials or keeping a secret, but also the correlation between people's real-world pro-sociality, like their likelihood of donating blood contingent on knowing that they volunteer on the weekend. And what we found is that those kinds of behaviors correlate between 0.1 and 0.25 across situations, so not very high. And what this suggests is that if you know enough about how people vary across situations and their likelihood of cooperating, then generalized morality really isn't for you. It's only when you know almost nothing about how someone is outside of a very narrow range of contexts where you know them that it's good to make these kinds of inferences and to assume that they'll behave similarly cooperatively or uncooperatively than what you've observed already.
It's one thing to say actual cooperativeness covaries across situations, correlates across situations, and mm-hmm. another to say that people can infer this cooperativeness. And of course, especially when people meet someone for the first time, meet a stranger, we know that there are so many biases that come in, of course, right? So people are really racist and their sexism can come through and there's all kinds of biases people have when they meet someone for the first time, especially when they don't know a lot about them, where their first impressions can be guided by a lot of unhelpful, damaging heuristics. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, how do you think about squaring this with maybe to some extent people can better than chance infer another's character? Maybe they should be relying on like past behavior more than like on obvious facial cues or skin color. How do you think about this tension?
Generalized morality, just because it can be adaptive for predicting behavior at above chance rates, it doesn't mean that it's something that we should be doing. And that goes with any social heuristic. What I'm trying to do in this paper is explain why it may have evolved over hundreds and hundreds of years in human society. I'm not trying to say this is definitely what we should be doing. And you could make the same argument for stereotypes. Stereotypes are really gross generalizations about groups based on correlations that are either much weaker than we assume or are illusory entirely. And so I think that what's really important to recognize is that as psychologists, we're trying to explain how these sort of biases or heuristics may have emerged, but we're not necessarily endorsing them as a way of living one's life. Personally, I think that biases like stereotypes or generalized morality are actually becoming less and less functional in more diverse societies, where our impressions of people are not only colored by our initial observations of how they behave, but also based on arbitrary social constructs like race and gender, and also by things like political party affiliation. And so I think that a tendency to label people as either I trust this person or I don't trust this person might actually be contributing to political polarization in the age of digital media, where people are more anonymous than they ever have been before. And so I think that generalized morality is helping people at above chance rates predict behavior, but the costs of generalized morality may be outweighing the benefits, especially in the 20th and 21st centuries.
I'm curious about the word accuracy here in whether people predict another person's moral character accurately. So let's say I do meet my neighbor after all. Let's say it's really sad. I really don't know my neighbor, but let's say the next time. And I finally meet them. And all I know about them is that the other day I saw them pet a cat outside. And I like cats. So I'm like, oh, they must be a good person. So I approach Tom with a lot of trust. And I say, hey, I asked them something. I trust them. I'm friendly. I'm kind. And they react kindly. I might be tempted to say I was accurate. They act kindly. They're a good person. Versus maybe my kindness brought that out in them in a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Let's say it's the other way around. Let's say I saw that they walked past a cat. And I'm like, oh, what a horrible person. Every time you see a cat, you have to stop and pet it. And so I approach them very differently, and Tom might react very differently and be like, oh God, why is this person just so aggressive to me? It might act in an unfriendly way. So that almost begs the question of what does it even mean to be accurate when people's moral character clearly isn't fixed, but might, to some extent, in specific situations, be subject to like self-fulfilling forces like that.
That's a really interesting scenario. Are you familiar with tit for tat? I can explain it for listeners either way.
Let's explain it.
Yeah, it's a strategy for cooperation in groups. And it's a really famous strategy. It was published, I think, in the 1980s by Robert Axelrod, a political scientist. And tit for tat is, I'm going to really generalize and not talk about the specifics of the game in which it was invented, but essentially you trust people immediately and then you just use whatever behavior you observed on the first time point to guide your decision. So if you trusted people and they screwed you over, then you don't trust them again until they cooperate with you again, and then you reestablish trust. If you trust people the first time and then they cooperate with you, then you continue to trust them until they give you a reason not to. It's a really effective strategy, because if everyone takes that strategy, no one ever is selfish to each other, because everyone begins with a default of trusting. Tit for tat is really good for groups. Generalized morality it's also good for individuals, but sometimes individuals with tit for tat can get screwed over. Generalized morality is good for the individual. So imagine that you see that neighbor and you see them pet the cat. Now, that might correlate at about 0.15 to 0.2 with their likelihood of being pro-social to you in other situations, holding constant all the other factors you talked about, whether you approach them pro-socially or not. And, you know, you're going to be wrong about 40% of the time with how you approach them, and you're going to be right about 60% of the time. Now, if you go about life that way, then you're going to create all these self-fulfilling prophecies on average in a way that benefits you. But as a society, it's not helpful for us all to go around and make assumptions that someone's bad in every kind of situation just because they passed a cat on the street. So this is exactly what I'm speaking about when I talk about you're accurate insofar as your predictions on average will be more accurate than chance. But for society, you're potentially spreading harmful social norms about how we should interact with each other. I'm not sure if that really dug at what you're trying to get at with that scenario.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it almost raises another question that's really interesting in terms of who would we punish more? Someone we see as generally a bad person, or someone where we have a more nuanced picture as they're loyal to their friends and harmful to the poor cat on the street? It seems like almost as if we have this more generalized character as bad, then maybe we punish them a little bit more.
Yeah, I think that's a big implication of the research. I haven't explored that fully, but actually, at the very beginning of the paper, I speak a little bit about the implications of this work for retributive versus rehabilitation modes of justice. If someone commits a crime and you take a generalized morality approach, then you think this person needs to be locked away forever because they can't be trusted in other kinds of situations. Whereas if you take a localized morality approach, you think there's one specific way this person might be morally deficient or might not be trustworthy, but this, I'm not going to pass judgment about their character holistically.
Do you think we also see ourselves as more uniformly good or bad as our network size increases?
We know ourselves better than anyone, or at least we like to think we do. Of course, we have a whole host of biases that might impair those self-judgments. I think that's a question I don't have data to answer. My intuition, my inclination is that we see ourselves with a great deal of nuance. I think that one theory that often comes up when I speak about generalized morality is attribution theory. So attribution theory is the extent to which you make an internal versus external attribution for your behaviors or others' behaviors. An internal attribution means that it's your kind of core character, your soul, whoever you were that caused some event to happen, versus an external attribution is when it was the situation that made you act a certain way. We really like to give ourselves internal attributions for good things and external attributions for bad things. The difference with generalized morality is that you can actually make internal attributions, but not generalize beyond the situation. So I can assume that person meant to pass by the cat, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be selfish or mean in other kinds of situations. But I think in the case of attributions and generalized morality, I think we both treat ourselves with a lot of nuance. We acknowledge the role of the situation. We acknowledge diversity in how we behave. And so I like to believe that people don't view themselves as good in all ways. At least I don't view myself as good in all ways, but perhaps that's a mistaken perception. It's a good question.
It's so cool. I also just got to say this. I loved reading this paper. It's such a cool idea. And it relates to something I've been thinking about that really puzzles me. So I study raw, generalized beliefs about human nature that people can have. Like, people are terrible, corrupt. Human nature is nasty, brutish, and short. Life is nasty, brutish, and short. Versus, no, people are good. And there's a lot of debates about how accurate one belief is or the other and which one should you hold. There's another more complex question of like, how do we even know? That's such a complicated statement. People can do so many things for so many reasons and we don't know. How do we even arrive at such a broad conclusion about, people are horrible, people are good? And it seems like your research is really filling a gap here where it's not just for individual others that we see as good or bad, but instead when we constantly have to think about humanity at large, a number of people, billions of people, much larger than anything we could really keep track of in an everyday life. Maybe that's what we have to default to, these like crude measures, just to have some sense of like how to operate with all these people.
That's a really interesting way of thinking about the research. I'm not sure if I'd quite connected to that, but it makes a lot of sense. I think that along the lines of what you've been saying, what we think about this is, in addition to our personal relationships, like my relationship with you or my relationship with my family or my relationship with the anonymous stranger next door, who you might want to introduce yourself to. In addition to those individual relationships, people just have a general operating scheme for how humans are. And generalized morality is that. When we have a default of generalized morality, then we start with these abstract construals and then we work our way down as we get to know people better. But without generalized morality, and I think in a lot of small scale societies, you actually don't start with those abstract construals. You start with a construal, I don't know someone, and I don't have any right to assume how they behave in other situations, and I'm going to just take the data as it comes to me. And what I've been alluding to throughout this call, and I think what you're getting at, is that those abstract construals can really help us navigate the world and predict how people might behave around us, but sometimes at the cost of group polarization or conflict in a society. And I do think there are a lot of ways of taking this research that explores that further. There's one question in the World Values Survey, which is a big survey of people around the world and the beliefs that they have. And this question is, most people can be trusted or cannot be trusted. I think that is maybe the most interesting question in the whole survey for me. And I still quite haven't got my head around the different ways that people answer that question. So maybe one day I'll have to interview you and you can tell me more about that.
In 20 years, we'll set it up and I'll know enough. But yeah, one finding in that space that I find so cool is that by and large, people tend to trust people more they know and have a more cynical view of human nature in general. So it's almost like everyone believes the world is on fire and everyone else is suffering and is a horrible person. But thank God I have my local community here of actually decent people. Yeah. But then it's not really possible for everyone to believe that and be correct, right? It's almost like maybe we have a really negative view of people at large, people we don't know, because of the news or social media. And you talk about this a little bit in your paper, where we just see the worst behavior of the worst people every day on a steady diet. And then, of course, maybe that might update our generalized morality of people at large in a way that's not always very helpful in these polarizing situations.
Yeah, I agree with that. Billy Brady and I, who's a professor here at Kellogg, where I'm working for another 10 days before starting my new position. But Billy and I have a paper that is forthcoming in Trends in Cognitive Sciences called Algorithm-Mediated Social Learning and Online Social Networks. And what we're talking about in that paper is the way that algorithms change how we learn about the world. And so consider this. Humans have evolved biases for negative social and moralistic information. And this is so that we know who not to trust and who to punish. Because in human societies, people being mean is actually quite rare, at least in the kinds of societies we've been living in for most of human history. But what social media does is it picks up on the fact that we really attend to that information and we click on it and we view it and we comment on it. And then it floods our news feeds full of this information about people disagreeing with each other and getting angry at each other. And what we're actually seeing is that people are developing really biased representations of how common these conflict scenarios are in the world. And it's actually affecting what we think social norms should be in especially cross-partisan interactions. And so we're developing this really skewed way of viewing the world. And alongside generalized morality, it's this recipe for partisan polarization, distrust of other people. And yeah, I don't mean to sound such a doomsday predictor, but I do think that these social learning biases and these strategies we've had for navigating our partners are intersecting in really interesting but also problematic ways.
Yeah, I remember communication scholars talking about the spiral of silence, where most people online are not even engaging in any sort of debate, helpful or not, because they think they misperceive this norm of, oh God, everyone is hostile and everyone will try to shut me down and be really mean to me. So why engage anyways? And then it becomes self-fulfilling and that doesn't seem to be too helpful. So can't wait to read that. And then we'll have to have both of you back on to talk about that paper. Okay, so maybe our generalized view of people as good or bad in this rough measure is not just a function of network size, but you think it's also a function of network moral diversity in more collectivistic cultures, let's say, where you have a tight culture and you have one moral system and everyone follows the same, be it a religious code, foe to behave morally or whatever moral code that is established. It seems once you interact with people outside of your moral system, maybe you don't trust them as much and you have a negative view and it's different than when you're in a community where you constantly run into people who have different moral systems from you, where then you understand, okay, I can't judge them by my moral system. I have to judge them by some global measure of good versus bad. I don't know. Does that make sense?
It does. It's a really complex question, actually. I'm trying to figure out exactly the best place to start. What I will say is that I study religion and some of my other work. In general, I'm interested in how the way that we think has changed across history. And religion's maybe a more important psychological process for understanding intergroup conflict and the evolution of human culture than any other. And one thing that you see in religion is a shift from gods that are concerned with very specific ethical violations, like you shouldn't go to this place or you shouldn't eat this food, to these really broad-based morals. Don't hurt, don't tattletale, don't lie, don't kill. And this actually happens simultaneously in multiple world regions, even in non-monotheistic or non-Abrahamic religions. And scholars like Peter Turchin, who's quantitative anthropologists at University of Connecticut, Harvey Whitehouse, who's at Oxford, have written about this necessity to expand moral dynamics as groups begin to collide and empires are built, where you have to coalesce a bunch of morally heterogeneous traditions. I think it's really plausible, and that could have facilitated generalized morality. I also think that growing group size may also have facilitated a more generalized view of morality that was then imposed on religious traditions. And so I think that there could be a reciprocal causality there. It's really fun to talk about these big historical questions, but also sometimes very unsatisfying because you can never quite get it the way that things have happened. And it's not as easy as a mediation that you might get from a psychological study.
For sure. For sure. Yeah, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that, actually, now as we're zooming out slowly to your research more broadly. I know that you have a lot of papers using methods that I think you would claim are underrated and underused in psychology, tying into really a field of historical psychology, as some people call it, understanding people in the past using methods of the present. How does it work? What are some of the methods that you are using that you think more psychologists would benefit from using to understand ourselves and our own history?
I'll start by just zooming out a little bit and speaking about just historical psychology and what I think about this idea. This is a movement that I've been a part of and that I think is really important in psychological science. Psychologists like to speak about how we're a young discipline, and we usually say that as a way of apologizing for the fact that our methods are still improving and our studies are sometimes we're still a discipline that's learning how to methodologically approach the questions we have and about the norms to regulate the way that scientists act. I think there's another way of interpreting that question, which is that all of our samples have come from the last 50 or 60 years and from a very small population of the world. We know from cultural psychology that the kinds of ecosystems that we inhabit, the way that we grow food, the environments we live around, but also the social institutions we're exposed to, like legal institutions and education systems and wars that might relate to our lives, that all of these things impact the way we think. We also know that these things have been happening for a long period of time. And so it seems really natural to not assume that the way that people think today is the way that they've always thought, and to want to study how processes of cultural evolution involving migration, warfare, urbanization have really profoundly shaped human psychology, and that we're never going to truly understand what makes human psychology human until we unpack that historical process a little better. And so in a lot of my work, I study how changes in these sort of socio-ecological processes like wars and migration, language development, urbanization, the scaling up of human societies, how these kinds of changes have interacted with psychology changes. And of course, you can't do this by bringing undergraduates into a lab. And I use a combination of computational methods like agent-based models, which actually we have an agent-based model in the generalized morality paper, also natural language processing, trying to understand how texts over time show the way that people have been thinking and the beliefs that we've held. We also have an NLP study in that generalized morality paper, and also ethnographic analysis. And so this is looking back at ethnographies that anthropologists have written in the 18th, 19th, and early 20th century about groups that are now either very much smaller, extinct, or assimilated into colonial powers, and then trying to turn those qualitative ethnographies into data sets that we can analyze by using quantitative methods. So I think those methods are really important for us to ask these big questions about historical psychology.
What do you think are some of the barriers of more people adopting these methods? Is it that they think they're not valid? Is it that people are scared of how complicated they must be when maybe they're more implementable than one might think? What do you think are some of the barriers?
It's a complicated question. It has a few different answers depending on how you take it on. So I'll say that they actually have been adopted in other disciplines. And so I think one of the biggest barriers is that well-known psychologists haven't really adopted them at scale, or not enough well-known psychologists. And so I think that they do exist in a lot of other disciplines, but there are a few barriers in general and also particular to psychology. I think one of the barriers is that a lot of these are computationally intensive methods. And I think that in methods classes right now in psychology departments, there isn't enough effort spent about building up coding abilities and computational approaches. And I think that's really a huge part of the future of our field. And so that's something that needs to change about methods classes. I think that another potential barrier is, and a barrier for these methods themselves, an inherent limitation, is that it's very difficult to establish causality with big data methods. And there have been a lot of controversies involving some of these methods where they've been applied mistakenly, or people have inferred too much from the kind of correlational data they're getting. And so I think some of the barriers involve psychology needing to grow, but some of the barriers involve these methods needing to continue to innovate. And in particular, methods of trying to reconstruct history using data about language, ethnography, and other kinds of artifacts that we might have.
Speaking of history, you have an interesting history. As someone studying culture for a reason, one might say, from the outside, reading your website, for example, you have been everywhere on this planet and lived in a lot of exciting places. Could you say a little bit about your background from where you were born and where you are now and how that might have influenced your research?
That was a very nice transition. Very smooth. Yeah, I've had a really fortunate life. interesting life in a lot of ways. I was born in Australia, and the first few years of my life, my parents were anthropologists. One of them still is an anthropologist. Another one was doing their dissertation before leaving the field. But we spent my first few years in Aboriginal settlements in Central Australia and Queensland, then moved to New Zealand, back and forth between New Zealand and Australia until I was six, largely because there weren't enough academic positions to accommodate anthropologists. And so it was just a way of staving off unemployment, really. And then moved to Denmark when I was eight on a one-year visiting professorship fellowship for my dad, which he managed to extend into 6 years. So we lived in Denmark for 6 years. And then when I was 14, we moved to the States. I lived in America for the first time. And that was just totally, that was a crazy experience. I had no idea how hardworking people were in America. I thought all Americans were lazy, but at least in the area, I was way behind on everything. It was a terrible year of high school. And after high school, I did my BA at McGill simply because it was more affordable than most American schools that I got into. And then went back to New Zealand. And when I was in New Zealand, I was faced with this really important dilemma because during my BA, I had started going down the route of social and cultural psychology. And then I had an identity crisis where I was thinking, God, I'm sorry about saying this on a podcast about psychology, but I was thinking like, what if SBSP burned down and everyone died inside? Would anyone notice?
Wow.
I know. And when you start as a BA, you don't really know what you're getting yourself into. And you've seen television shows about psychologists. And then you realize that this field is really still growing. It's really in its early stages, and that you as a young psychologist are really going to be responsible for cultivating it. And that's a really scary feeling. And I was hoping to get involved in this field where everyone could tell me, oh, this is, everyone knows everything about these things and you can fill in this gap here. And that really wasn't the case. And so when I moved to New Zealand, I actually considered leaving social psychology and going into clinical psychology. And I took a position at a center for rehabilitating domestic abusers.
Huh.
And I was on the plane there. I had this job, or I had a potential job. I hadn't signed the contract. And I was looking back through all of the work that I'd done in my undergrad. And I just realized how much I loved this work and how much I was going to miss doing this research, and how there are really important ways that I was missing about how it intersects with society. And so I panicked in the airport on the way to New Zealand, and I emailed all these social psychology professors throughout New Zealand saying, hey, I'm going to be in this country in a day. Do you have any jobs available? Do you need someone to clean up around the lab? And two people replied. And one of them was Jamin Halberstadt, who works at University of Otago, and where I ended up doing a lab manager job for a year. And honestly, it was really fortunate that I realized that this was what I loved to do, because it was always what I had found most interesting. And Jamin was a phenomenal mentor. And so that kind of began the path that I went down to where I am today.
And speaking of productivity, where you said in high school you were feeling a little bit behind when you came to America.
It wasn't just feeling behind. I was getting straight D's.
Sure. That's fair.
There was some evidence.
It seems that you have found some way to be more productive. Usually academics do one of two things. They publish a lot of papers in bad journals, but they have a lot of publications, or they publish a few papers in good journals. You have decided to publish a lot of papers in really good journals, which seems like an interesting strategy and is really inspiring. And so my question here, I guess, is how on earth are you doing it? And what are your productivity hacks? So I know you were presenting this at SBSB. It didn't burn down. We should say that this is a conference for social and personality psychologists from around the world. It didn't burn down, but the room was lit up with your wonderful advice on productivity. And so I wonder, many of our listeners won't have been there, if you could just share some of your advice on how to be productive and still stay sane and have a fun life.
First of all, I'm very glad that SBSB did not burn down, and that it has not burned down so far. These are the thoughts of a kid in college who was trying to grapple with his future. So don't take that too seriously, I hope. That was a great session. I should thank Max Bai for organizing it. I think he's doing it again this year. So if you're listening and you're a undergraduate or graduate student and you're looking to hear from people, have are wanting to share tips for their own success and their own productivity, then I highly recommend going. I think I know Mohammed Atari and Kira Hudson are both speaking this year, so it should be a really great session. I started my session by saying I had really didn't know what to say, because productivity is a really nebulous concept. And what you don't want to do is get up and say, it's publish or perish, and here's how to publish and not perish, because the institution itself is problematic and has resulted in some problematic habits throughout our discipline's history. For me, I never really actually thought of myself as someone who was doing really well or who was really productive. I think that honestly, it was a side effect of early rejection. So I applied to graduate school that first year in New Zealand. I applied to social psychology programs back in the States, and I didn't get into anything. I got totally washed out and I didn't even get an interview. No one even emailed me. I remember I had one correspondence with a professor. I was applying for the NSFG RFP, which is an award for applying to graduate school and getting funded throughout graduate school. And I asked this person, I need to put a name on my application for a potential PI. Could you be that person? And he said, put me on it as long as I don't need to commit to anything. That was the one implied. So that was my only communication in my first application cycle. And I remember that night that I realized it hit home. It was way after it should have hit home. But when I realized that I wasn't getting in anywhere, and it was this life that I had really devoted myself to and this discipline that I loved. And I think the switch clicked and I was thinking, okay, I can either go a different direction or I can really double down. And I started working a lot harder and I threw myself into research. And at first it was a blind throwing myself into research. I was just trying to do everything I could to start papers and to start collaborations. But eventually it took shape as finding the strategies that worked for me. And that kind of culminated eventually in papers. In terms of concrete steps, I would say one way that you can translate that story is that waiting always pays off. If you're an undergraduate and you're considering applying to graduate school, it's always a good idea to take a year or two, work in a lab manager job or a data analysis job, because you learn so much in those positions, not only about how to do research, but also the norms of research. And you're going to be so much better equipped to hit the ground running when you start your graduate career. Most people who I know who've left graduate school have come directly from their undergraduate degrees and realized they really had misperceived the norms of graduate school. And then other things that I think I learned before I even started graduate school was the kinds of activities that really pay off and the kinds of activities that don't go anywhere. And so one activity that I don't think people do enough of is write. As a graduate student, often you don't have that much to write about right away. But if you can find time to write, not only are you making progress towards papers, but you also are really challenging yourself to put your ideas in a form where they can be communicated to readers more clearly. And often I'll find that if I just start writing about something, I'll come away with a clearer idea of how to approach a data analysis than I did before I started writing. And to this end, I think that often a lot of the time that we spend in meetings and looking over code, we aren't seeing clearer routes to the problem that we're working on. If you've ever been sitting in front of your laptop trying to do like a latent profile analysis for 4 weeks, like I can't figure out how to fit this parameter. And then you realize that, oh, actually, this is just an interaction. Why am I doing this really complicated method? I think this happens to all of us. And if you can learn how to cut down on the activities that don't go anywhere and prioritize the ones that do go somewhere, that goes a long way. Like I remember a lot of my friends in graduate school, they'd have these schedules packed full of meetings they didn't need to go to or workshops that weren't actually very helpful. And if you can leave that schedule open and seem less busy, but you're actually spending that time writing and applying for things, I think that sometimes can really pay off. Another thing that I think helped early on was that I applied from the first year of graduate school. I applied to a lot of conferences and a lot of opportunities like fellowships and awards. And those paid off in a big way. Often a lot fewer people apply to fellowships than you think. And so when you submit applications, you think, oh, I'm among hundreds, but really you're among like 10. I just reviewed for an award and I assumed that it was going to be like 50 or 60 people and 12 applied. So it's always a smaller pool than you think. And this is a big award. Conferences are so helpful early in grad school, because even though you don't really know what you're doing yet, like I remember presenting at a conference and I think back to that presentation and it was terrible, but you meet so many people that you will see for the next few years, leverage mirror exposure. Get those people to recognize your face, and that can really pay off later. A couple other things. One is, all of these are just things that worked for me. But one thing that really worked for me is a sweet spot of how many mentors to work with. I found that working with 2 to 3 mentors was a real sweet spot. Whenever I got beyond that, I felt totally overwhelmed. And whenever I was working with just one person, even if they were great, often there were periods of time that we didn't really have anything to work on because we had something under review and we didn't really have another idea to go on right away. I found that 2 to 3, you always have something to work on, but you never feel like totally lost in the weeds and what project do I do next? And projects don't linger for years and years. And then the last thing that I think was a concrete tip that worked for me was mixing primary and secondary data in papers. So mixing archival and experimental studies. One way to do it is a very strategic way that journals can both see the internal and external validity of what you're doing. But another reason to mix that data is often you have a great idea and experiment, and then you'll go and test it in archival data, and it won't work at all, the same correlation. And it will really make you think more deeply about the idea and about the implications and the potential limitations. And so it just helps you make the idea stronger before you submit it to publication. And so I don't want to just speak for half an hour about things that may or may not work for people, but those were a few that stuck out from that session I was participating in.
Yeah, that's terrific. As we're coming to an end, I want to mention that by the time this episode airs, you will be a professor. You are an incoming assistant professor at Booth at UChicago, which is an exciting position. So congratulations. And I want to use the last couple minutes to just ask you, how do you feel about this big life transition? Are you excited? What are some uncertainties you have?
Oh, man, that's a whole other podcast episode. Uncertainties. There have always been so many uncertainties. I think that I assumed that imposter syndrome would go away as you get older. And I think that sometimes it just gets worse. You walk in the booth and they have all of these oil paintings of the Nobel Prize winners from the past. And just what am I doing here? I'm from like a old psychology building that had mothballs and lab rooms that could fit one chair. It helped. So to the point that I made earlier about waiting always helps. I took a year after I got offered this job. I deferred it. And I think that went a long way. I started working. I have actually begun working with an incredible graduate student at Booth named Dan Medvedev, and working with him has been great because it's given me insight both into the amazing pool of graduate students at the university, but also just given me confidence that I can work on projects where I'm the most senior person on the project. And I think that's something that a lot of people entering faculty jobs wonder late at night. Is it just the people who have propped me up that are the reason for me getting to the point I am now? Otherwise, it does seem like it's just a lot of the same. I think that academia is a unique environment because our first real job comes in the middle of our career, especially now that there are so many amazing people in our field that feel like they're qualified to get tenure when they get offered a job. Like so many of my colleagues, I feel that way about. And so on the one hand, I do feel nervous and this is the beginning of my career. But on the other hand, this just feels like a continuation of what I've been putting my life towards for the last 15 years. And so there's a sense of confidence and stability that I get from that. I think that I've tried not to overthink it. I know what I love to do. I love to do research and I love to write and I love to have these discussions. And I just hope that's what I get to keep doing for the next 40 years of my career.
Perfect note to end on. Thank you so much for making the time. And yeah, congratulations on the job. And I have no doubts it's going to be great and your students will be lucky to be mentored by you.
Thanks so much, Eric. This was a really stimulating conversation and some of the best questions I've gotten about that paper. I really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you for listening. Following Robert Cialdini's advice here on this podcast, let's see if I can convince you to take about 5 seconds of your valuable time and leave us a quick review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or elsewhere. This podcast has been a labor of love by several wonderful young folks here in the department, and we have been surprised by the ever-increasing reach the podcast has had. We are near 500,000 downloads a year and a half since we started, with tens of thousands of new downloads and thousands of new followers every single month in nearly every country around the world. Help us make even more people excited about psychology by leaving us a review or subscribing to our no spam, all fun Substack at Stanford Psy Pod to connect with other listeners, or shoot us an email with your thoughts or suggestions at stanfordpsychpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, and have a wonderful psyched day.